And with me back for a return visit is labor historian Philip Foner. He's the author of over 60 books, including the 6-volume history of the labor movement in the United States and the 2-volume Women in the American Labor Union Movement. He was a professor emeritus at Lincoln University and last semester was a visiting professor at Haverford College. He's got an article this week in The Nation and was quoted in an article this morning in The Inquirer on the IWW. Philip Foner has taught around the world, including universities in China, Poland, Cuba, and the Soviet Union. Today we're going to discuss the subject of one of his new books. It's called Kate Richards O'Hare, and it's a collection of her writings and speeches, edited by Foner and Sally Miller. Kate Richards O'Hare was one of the leaders of the International Socialist Movement at the beginning of the century. She was active in the anti-war movement around World War I. She served a 14-month jail sentence and following that became a prison reform activist. Kate Richards O'Hare is published by the Louisiana State University Press. And Philip Foner, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Well, good to be back.
What's Kate Richards O'Hare's importance historically?
Well, for two reasons. First, she was an activist in the fight for women's freedom in America, suffrage, and the right of women to economic equality with men. And secondly, she was the outstanding woman socialist in America, a member of the National Executive Committee, was almost nominated for vice president in 1916 on the socialist ticket, was actually nominated for governor on one state, and was well known internationally because she was a member of the Internationalist Socialist Bureau. And yet it's a sad situation that you can turn to the index of hundreds and hundreds of American history books and you'll never find a single mention of Kate Richards O'Hare. And today what makes her especially significant is that she was a very militant fighter against war and went to prison for her principles.
Well, why do you think she's not included in the history books?
Because history books are written from the standpoint of ignoring the real best traditions of the American people. As a result, not only Kate Richards O'Hare, but many others at the time who are important are hardly mentioned at all. So my job has been to make these people better known today. They were well known in their day. It's not as if we're exaggerating the significance of people. Kate Richards O'Hare was a national figure in the period from 1903, 1910, and 1916. She traveled, lectured all over the United States and the famous socialist encampments where people came in Kansas, South Dakota, North Dakota, Minnesota, and camped for days on end during the summertime to listen to Debs, Mother Jones, Kate Richards O'Hare, and she was one of the most active lecturers on the socialist circuit at that time. She was the editor of a very important paper called The National Ripsaw, the socialist paper published in Girard, Kansas. She wrote for The Appeal to Reason, which was probably one of the most popular weeklies in the United States, having almost over a million circulation by the time she was writing, not only among workers, but among farmers. And so when we are putting together her writings, we are putting together writings which reached many, many Americans. And we're not resurrecting some obscure figure who wasn't of any significance. We're trying to show that this part of our history is worth knowing about and learning from, because after all, the Socialist Party was able to garner for Eugene Victor Debs in the election of 1912 a million votes at a time when maybe 3-4 million was considered to be the top vote. And when Debs ran for president of the United States in 1920 while he was in prison for opposing the war, he got over a million votes. At that time, it was suggested that maybe Kate Richards O'Hare, who was also in prison for opposing the war, should run with him as vice president. But then the party felt that two prison candidates might be a little too much for the American people, so she wasn't nominated.
What were the principles of the Socialist Party at the time that she was active in it?
Well, the Socialist Party was a mass party, but it was also a party with a great deal of conflict within it. There were different wings of the Socialist Party. There was what was called the right wing, which was symbolized by Victor Berger of Milwaukee. And then there was the center that was symbolized by Morris Hillquit of New York. And then there was the left wing, Big Bill Haywood. Eugene Victor Debs gravitated more to the left, although he didn't get so much involved in many things. Kate Richards O'Hare tended to be in the center. She was not right, but she also wasn't left. But she was a militant socialist. What do I say that she wasn't a left socialist? She still believed, as did many socialists, that the solution to all problems would come through the ballot box. If you elect enough officials, you will be able to solve all your problems and you'll gain socialism that way. Of course, the left felt that that was a rather utopian concept of socialism, that the ruling class would not allow the people really to take power through the ballot box. And in fact, one of the socialist novelists who probably, when I mention it, will come as a surprise to many people that he was a socialist novelist, but Jack London wrote a novel called The Iron Heel, precisely to educate those socialists who believed, like Kate Richards O'Hare, that through the ballot box everything would be solved. The Iron Heel dealt with a situation when the socialists do win control, and then the Iron Heel stamps down, taking away their right to vote, and establishes a terrible system of repression. Anatole France later said this is the forecasting of fascism in this novel. So Kate Richards O'Hare was an interesting person, but not really on the left of the party, but militant, and that's the important thing. Another interesting thing about her is that she became a member of the Machinist Union, the first woman to be allowed to join the union. Her father was a machinist in Kansas, and she became a secretary, but she felt that she was better suited to do manual work. And so she studied, learned an apprenticeship of a machinist. And then when she was capable of doing the work, she went to the union and applied for membership. Well, they wouldn't allow her to become a member. They said, we can't allow a woman to belong to the Machinist Union. Well, she put up a terrific fight in the Kansas local and finally forced them to accept her into membership. And this is the quality that she had. She wouldn't take no, and she wouldn't allow women to be treated as second-class citizens. So she then began a fight to expand the right of women to belong to unions. And she is important in that sense, too. Her writings indicate that.
What was her participation in the suffrage movement?
Well, she was very active in the socialist suffrage movement. Her participation was a very important one because women socialists were a very significant role, a group in the suffrage movement because many of the middle-class suffragettes at the time could not reach the working-class women. They were alienated from them, and many of them weren't even interested in the working-class women. But the women socialist suffragists believed very strongly that without the ballot box, women were crippled. And so, in fact, one of her articles that I include in here is called that... It deals with this question, shall women vote, and is an article that says that women are people with one hand tied behind their back because they can't vote. Therefore, nobody pays attention to their needs. The legislators won't pass any laws in the interest of women workers. So she organized a lot of the socialist women suffrage movements at the time and played a very big role in that. And there's a whole section of this book of her writings on the suffrage question. And I think that the women in the socialist movement, and men too, made a very important contribution to the women's suffrage movement by bringing working class women into the struggle for the right to vote.
Was it unpopular amongst certain socialist people to be such a supporter of the vote, since I think a lot of socialists felt that socialists probably wouldn't be voted into office, so it was a useless
only
tool.
The most let's put it this way. That wing of the socialist movement that was associated with the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, or the anarchist, the anarcho-syndicalist wing, that didn't believe in political action at all and felt that the revolution would come and socialism would come through the general strike or direct action, tended to scoff at the right to vote. A good example of that was Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who was then in the IWW and also in the socialist movement, was not a suffragist, who felt that the ballot was a waste of time, that you should devote all your attention to improving the condition on the job and organizing for the general strike. But that didn't represent the majority position. The majority position of the Socialist Party was to fight for women's suffrage. Well, it stands for reason. If you believe in the right to vote as an instrument, or the vote as an instrument for getting socialism, if you increase the vote of the working class by giving working class women the vote, you supposedly increase the strength of the Socialist Party in the future. So it's natural that they would fight for the right to vote.
She was a prominent figure in the International Socialist Movement. Was it unusual for a woman to have that much power within the movement?
No, it was unusual for an American woman. But in, for example, Clara Zetkin of the German Social Democratic Party and the founder of International Women's Day at the Copenhagen Second International Convention in 1910 was a very important figure in the International Socialist Movement. But for an American woman to be active and a representative was unusual. In part, that was because, and this is typical of many of these radical movements and reform movements, while the Socialist Party could pass good resolutions for women's suffrage and other things, when it came to putting women into positions of leadership, the men forgot about it. It was still a male supremacist party, and women had to fight very hard to exercise any influence in the leadership role of the party. And that is why the American Party, even true of the German Party, but especially the American Party. So when Kate Richards O'Hare was actually nominated for the International Socialist Bureau and went to Europe, it was a very important step forward.
Would you call her a feminist?
No. I think very few socialists at that time were feminists. There were those who were. But generally, socialist women were not feminists because they believed that the achievement of socialism would eliminate all the differences between men and women in society. That is, all the problems that stem from capitalism, of exploitation of women or inferiority of women, would disappear with the achievement of socialism. Therefore, they didn't believe that there was such a thing as a natural anti-woman position among men. Some of them may believe it privately, but publicly they didn't say so. And they believed, for example, many of them were very much influenced by Babel's famous book, Women and Socialism, which took the view that once you get socialism, all these problems are solved. However, a number of them, through disillusionment with the male supremacy in the Socialist Party, became socialist feminists. You take even Kate Richards O'Hare. When she went to prison, she was so antagonized by the fact that the party paid all attention to the men who were in prison for anti-war activities and ignored her and her role because she was a woman, that she emerged from prison closer to the socialist feminist than ever before, you see. So often experience might have that effect in that respect.
Let me reintroduce you for listeners just joining us. I'm speaking with labor historian Philip Foner, and we're discussing the subject of one of his new books. It's called Kate Richards O'Hare, and it's a collection of her writings and speeches, and it's just been published by the Louisiana State University Press. And you mentioned that she was an anti-war activist and, in fact, got imprisoned because of those views. What charges specifically was she imprisoned for?
Well, you have to recognize that the Socialist Party in my opinion, the shining hour of the American Socialist Party occurred during World War I, because when everyone was beginning to support the idea of going to war, except some few people, the Socialist Party conducted a very consistent anti-war movement. They took the view that the war in Europe was an imperialist war, and that the effort to involve the United States in that war was an effort to drag America into an imperialist war in the interests of Wall Street, the bankers, and the capitalists. And they accused Woodrow Wilson of betraying his promise in the election of 1916 when he said he kept us out of war, and they fought against it. Now, the American Socialist Party is, in one sense, a very unique party. Every other socialist party in the world, except one, the one in Russia, immediately when the war broke out, supported their government, even though historically the socialists had been opposed to the idea of supporting their government. Yet when World War I broke out, the German Social Democrats supported the Kaiser, the French socialists supported the French government, the British Labour Party, which was really the socialist wing, supported England. Only the Russians, the Russian party, rejected the idea of supporting the Russians. The second party to do so was the American Socialist Party. When the United States entered the war on April 6, 1917, after Wilson went to Congress and for a joint session and called for a declaration of war, the Socialist Party called an emergency convention in St. Louis 2 weeks later. And the United States was already in war. The Socialist Party had to take up the question, what should our position now be that the United States has gone to war? And Kate Richards O'Hare was made the chairperson of the majority of the committee to make the decision. And so that was a very important position to give a woman, because it was a critical question. And she played a very big role in achieving the majority position, which was, it was an imperialist war before the United States went into the war. It's still an imperialist war. The United States was went in against the interests of the American people, and we oppose it, and we will continue to fight the war. And that was adopted. Now, of course, some socialists like Upton Sinclair and Charles Edward Russell and even their presidential candidate, Benson, in 1916, broke with the party and left because of it and supported the war. But when the resolution, which she had played a role in drafting, was submitted to a referendum vote of the membership, it was overwhelmingly supported. Then she went on a lecture tour around the country speaking against the war, not saying that people shouldn't enlist, or because she knew that they were watching her and listening to her. In fact, there was a Department of Justice agent in every one of her speeches, taking down what she said, because the Espionage Act was passed, which said that any interference with the war would be judged act of treason or a criminal act, and could, if found guilty, be sent to prison for 10 or more years and fined, 20 years, in fact. So she was very careful. But in one of her speeches in North Dakota, there wasn't a Department of Justice person there. And the person who took down what she said fabricated what she said. She really didn't say what they said she said, but they found that something she had said, they accused her of urging people not to enlist in the army. And she was brought to trial, and before a jury that was completely against the socialists, found guilty, a judge who was very hostile to her, she was found guilty. And after the appeals were turned down by the Supreme Court, she was the first woman to go to prison for opposing the war in World War I. Actually, she was the first to be indicted, but not the first to go to prison because her case was later. She joined a rather important group, Eugene Victor Debs, Charles Ruthenberg, hundreds, and of course, over 100 or more of the IWW were picked up on the Espionage Act. It was a terrible period. You couldn't open your mouth in opposition to the war, and what made it even worse was that it was all carried out under the leadership of a president who claimed to be a great Democrat, believing in the principles of the new freedom, and who under whom the worst sort of repression took place. So she finally, she went to prison. She was sentenced to 10 years and fined $5,000. The Wobblies, by the way, were sentenced to 20 years and fined $10,000 each. Finally, she was pardoned by Woodrow Wilson. The prison experience was very important in her life because she learned how terrible the conditions in the prisons were at that time for women prisoners as well as men, you see. And she, her letters from prison, which we have in this book, are marvelous documents about what life was like in the prisons at that time. And she devoted herself after she came out of prison to the fight for prison reform, plus other things, but she became very important in the work for prison reform.
Herself for a while was right next door to Emma Goldman's. Was that, yeah, was that a coincidence?
Well, Emma Goldman also was opposed to the war and went to prison on that ground. Yes, it wasn't a coincidence. That happened to be the women's prison in Missouri, and there was a special section for political prisoners, and who were not given any special treatment, by the way. They were made to work long hours, making... there were many things. For example, although the labor movement had fought for a tremendous number of years to eliminate convict labor in terms of competition. Goods made in prison would then be sold in the open market to at cheap prices because the prisoners weren't paid anything, and cut down the work of union labor. Missouri still, the federal prison still used them. And one of the things she conducted a fight while she was in prison against was this system of using prison labor to compete with union labor outside. A very interesting person.
So what were some of the other conditions that she found in prison that led her to become a prison reform activist?
Well, for example, prisoners were not allowed to talk to each other. During every meal, they had to be completely silent. They were only permitted to talk a certain short period each day. The result was terrible neurotic conditions developed among the prisoners. In addition to what, the sanitary facilities were terrible, the crowding and everything else. And she was mixed up with all kinds, prostitutes, etc., and got an insight into what the conditions were that led them to this work. So when she came out, she became active in prison reform, and she worked in California. After her husband died, she married another person in California and became a member of the Prison Reform Commission in California and helped draw up a new prison program, and is considered to be one of the major pioneers in prison reform in the United States.
Did that find her working with a different set of people than the socialists who she worked with before she was in prison?
Well, when she came out, she still was a socialist, but the Socialist Party had split, you see, the Socialist Party had split. The left wing had been, if you've seen the picture Reds, you may remember that the Communist Party was formed out of the left wing of the Socialist Party because, if you remember Reds, the right wing wouldn't let the left wing delegates come to the convention hall in Chicago. So they split and formed two Communist Party, which eventually became the Workers' Party. Well, she came out of prison when this all was taking place, and she found herself in a Socialist Party whose ranks had been very much decimated, either due to the espionage or to the split of the left. And so she wasn't as active anymore in the socialist movement as she had been before. I don't mean to say she wasn't active. For example, one of her big crusades was called the Children's Crusade. She mobilized the children children of men who were still in prison because of opposition to war to on a march to Washington to go to President Harding and try to get them to pardon their parents. And it was a very moving episode. But her major work was in prison reform.
Was it held against her amongst other reformers that she'd been active in the Socialist Party?
No, no, no. She was a very distinct. After all, she had, by that time, it was considered to be an honor to have gone to prison for opposing the war. After all, Eugene V. Debs and many others were famous for that. And the only woman, really, socialist to be in prison, she was a very distinguished person in that sense. And also, everybody recognized that her experience in prison gave her a certain amount of value as a prison reformer, because she could talk from personal experience of what life was like in the prison.
Philip Foner is my guest, and we're discussing the subject of his new book on Kate Richards O'Hare. As you mentioned, she went to prison in the first place because she was an anti-war activist. You have an article in the current edition of The Nation on the concept of the war referendum, and I think you mentioned to me that this was something she was interested in, too.
Yes. You see, in 1916, there was quite a big movement at that time, which was especially associated with the Socialist Party, for a referendum. After all, the danger of the United States becoming involved in war in 1916 was very strong, not simply the war in Europe, but also the war against Mexico because of the punitive expedition. Pershing was sent over to Mexico to chase down General Pancho Villa. You may remember his attack on New Mexico and Colombia. And so it was a great danger that the United States would get involved either in a war with Mexico or get involved in a war with Germany. So Alan Benson, who was the candidate for president of the Socialist Party in the election of 1916, Debs didn't want to run at that time. He was very famous for his idea of a referendum, and she worked with him on that. The idea of the referendum was that if the United States wants to declare war against another country, not if the United States is attacked, but if the United States wants to declare war, then the president and Congress must first submit this to a referendum. And if the referendum if the referendum is against going to war, then the nation can't go to war. If it's for, etc. And he had a rather cute idea, Benson, namely that those who voted for going to war, their names would be recorded, would be the first to be sent. And newspaper editors and others who clamored for war would also be the first to be sent. So that the idea was that warmongering and jingoism would thereby be reduced. Incidentally, Senator Robert M. La Follette of Wisconsin, a Republican, introduced that thing into the Senate of the United States. And he came up with a similar idea that the Bureau of Census should hold a referendum and determine whether people wanted to go to war or not. So that was very popular in America at that time. And I wrote this article about it, saying at the end that even though it did not, the anti-war referendum has an honorable history in this country. The reason I wrote this article was that President Reagan accused the referendum on the nuclear freeze having been concocted by the Soviet Union and Soviet agents being the ones to carry it through. And I was annoyed at that because I felt that the history of this country is being distorted. After all, it's a very popular idea of a referendum in 1916. And so I wrote this article, and I ended up, I said, now when the increasing likelihood of a nuclear holocaust puts everyone at risk, and when the administration calls for first strike weapons and discusses nuclear war fighting capabilities, the need for citizens to have a voice in the matter is more urgent than ever. Benson and La Follette's proposals did not stop World War I, but their modern counterpart may help prevent World War III. So it's interesting. It's another example of how aspects of American history, which seem to be so startling, are absolutely unknown by so many people in this country. The American people were not startled in 1916 with the idea that people should have a right to vote on whether they should go to war or not. It was a big issue in discussion in Congress and outside in the nation as a whole.
Do you think that concept could work today? I know you think that the nuclear freeze referendum is related to it, but do you think there could be a war referendum?
Well, I think when the world is at stake, it's a good idea to discuss it. I think that the issue should be put on the table for discussion. In other words, like Benson, I'm not saying that if the nation is attacked, but in the case that we are talking about sending troops anywhere, because it suits the interests of certain groups in this country, would be a good idea to reconsider the referendum. I would say that at the time of the Tonkin Bay resolution, the idea of a referendum would have been very helpful for the future of the United States.
Labor historian Philip Foner is my guest, and we've been discussing his new
Tonkin
book.
Gulf,
on,
by the way.
What?
The Tonkin Gulf.
We've been discussing his new book, Kate Richards O'Hare, and also his book on women in the American labor movement has recently been published in paperback. And Kate Richards O'Hare was one of the first women in an American union. Now that they're
okay.
Get it straight for me.
All right, actually,
in the machinist union. Union, right? Now that there are many unions like that are open to women, do you think that women are affecting the direction that the labor movement is headed in any way?
Not enough. Yes, but not enough. I think that the this is a very serious problem that the labor movement has to do more than just pay lip service to. And actually, it's the life and death of the labor movement is in many ways linked up to this question, for the simple reason that more and more women are going into work, especially service industries and other industries where the shift now is so much in away from the blue-collar field. And even there are more women, by the way, miners and others. And the degree of unionization of women is still very low. And as the increase in the number of women grows and the degree of unionization does not, well, the percentage of unionized workers is going to decline. So the labor movement must come to grips with this. They're doing more than they used to, but still it's not sufficiently aware. There's not enough awareness of it. And I hope this book, Women in the American Labor Movement, From the First Trade Unions to the Present, in paperback, will help to create a better understanding of how important this question is.
So you think that unions that are unreceptive to women are really spiting themselves?
Well, they're cutting off their nose. That's really what it is. Let me put it this way. It's not today you will not find too many unions who will say women's place is in the home and therefore we don't want to bother with them. But there's a lot of difference between saying, yes, women should be organized and doing something about it. And I feel very strongly that they have to get more active. Actually, the labor movement has to be active on many fronts, not just women. They have to do more on the whole question of unemployment and the closing down of industries. It's a big problem, and we could spend many hours on this question.
Well, maybe we'll spend some more time on that in the near future. We're out of time now, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Philip Foner has been my guest. He's a Philadelphia-based labor historian who's written many books.